chosen. Living my life like it's golden. I'm rolling, spinning my dice like I'm bowling. Supposing, tipping my toe tips, a grown thing inspired. Walking a bit more like Moses. The road is mean as it was then from way back. Frick the government, you tell them that I say that I'm aimed at phony MPs and house triggers. Pussy old token, screws and head figures. Obligatory rag-a-moth, panic, I'm mangling, strangling him or her that choose to concur that the works ain't relevant. I'm telling them, spelling it out in plain English from 1994. When a man's been in this before that, when shit was worse. So what if I choose to kick up and curse? Expose the torture, expose the hurt.
T-R-U-F-F, across the world, we're cuffing everywhere. T-R-U-F-F, across the world, we're cuffing everywhere.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And welcome back, everyone, to CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to Radio Resistance. This is Chris Scott in studio running the show today as part of Off the Hour News and Views from Haiti and the Diaspora. On today's program, The Price of Occupation. On October 13th, the UN Security Council renewed its mandate for peacekeeping troops in Haiti who will stay until October 15th of next year. But is the $500 million being spent, or the $3 billion spent in Haiti since 2004, doing any good? We will be speaking to two commentators on this issue, to Brian Kincannon from the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and we'll be speaking to Marguerite Laurent from the Haitian Lawyers Action Network. So we will be speaking to those two experts. Haiti Solidarity, Haiti Action Montreal is responsible for this program. We are broadcasting from a perspective of solidarity and self-determination for the Haitian people. Thanks for listening. So we will come right back to you after this. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Radio Resistance, news and views from Haiti. As we said in the introduction on today's program, we'll be talking about the consequences of the UN occupation in Haiti. The MINUSTAH, the Mission for the Nations Unies for la Stabilisation en Haïti, is on the ground in Haiti since the aftermath of a coup against Haiti's elected government in 2004. So it's been 5 years already that the UN mission has been in Haiti. Supposedly it's a peacekeeping mission, but as one of our collaborators has pointed out, this is the first time when a UN mission has been on the ground, not to enforce an already existing peace treaty, but rather to put or to stabilize a government that is really contested by its people. The Haitian elected government was overthrown in a coup d'etat on February 29th, 2004. And since then, or subsequent to that, Haiti was run by an appointed president who was actually living in Florida until the coup d'etat, and basically was put in place by the same powers that overthrew Haiti's elected government, with a mandate of enforcing business as usual, of really opening Haiti to business, to making sure that wages were kept low, to making sure that mining regulations were friendly to businesses that wanted to invest in Haiti. And the fact that the previous Aristide government had been actually aiming to raise minimum wages, to regulate mining companies, and to really make the economy and the society work for the Haitian people certainly had something to do with the fact that Haiti's government was overthrown. So 5.5 years after the fact, Haiti Action Montreal is really still following the news on the ground in Haiti. We're going to be starting the show today with an interview with Brian Kincannon. Brian is a human rights lawyer who's employed with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, a very consistent observer of the Haitian scene. And we're going to be talking to him about the U.S. role in peacekeeping missions. Under the Obama administration, we've seen something of a sea change in the rhetoric. The focus and talk has now been on engaging the hemisphere, on dialogue, on becoming a player in the United Nations, which, of course, the previous Republican administration was skeptical of. But the question really is this enough? Is what we need more U.S. Troops on the ground in Haiti, or more U.S. money for these stabilization missions, if what the money is going for is really training police? Is that the solution to Haiti's problems? It's certainly an open question, which we're going to address to Brian Kincannon. And the backdrop to this interview is that last August, the United States announced it will be paying $2.2 billion to the UN peacekeeping missions across the world, internationally. The U.S. had owed some money in arrears from the Bush administration. Typically, the U.S. pays about $2 billion a year to peacekeeping missions throughout the world, and this is a quarter of the entire budget for UN peacekeeping missions. So the question is, in some circles, it seems progressive that the U.S. is actually re-engaging with the UN, but the question is that the solution? Is that what we want? Is another $2 billion in paying for tanks and cops really what is going to bring long-lasting peace and economic justice to Haiti? To address that issue, we're going to speak to Brian Kincannon from the Institute for Justice and Democracy. Here is Brian. Okay, so on the line we have Brian Kincannon, a frequent guest on this show, director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, speaking to us from Oregon, frequent commentator on U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Haiti. Mr. Kincannon, the U.S. has often been criticized for not being a full player at the U.N., for really undermining the mission of the U.N., for not pulling its weight. Recently in August, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, announced that the U.S. will be paying $2.2 billion in peacekeeping money. This is mostly arrears that was overdue from the Bush and previous administrations. Now that the Obama administration seems to be engaging more actively in the UN, do you see this contribution to peacekeeping money as a positive thing?
I would say it's provisionally positive. The positive part is it's a sign that the U.S. is retreating a little bit on the policy of exceptionalism. We've got a long tradition of saying rules are really good for everybody else, but don't apply to us. And the fact that we're not paying our financial obligations, but also it's across the board. The U.S. refuses to sign treaties and other international conventions that almost everybody else in the world will sign. And the fact that President Obama has now agreed to pay the arrears and to fulfill the U.S. financial obligations, I think that's a sign of at least pulling back a little bit from the exceptionalism policy. And I said provisional because one big issue is, I think it's great that the U.S. is paying the U.N. some money, but the big question is how is that used? And I've worked with the U.N. I worked in the U.N. in Haiti in 1995 and 1996, and I followed the U.N. In Haiti over the last 6 years. And from that, I can say that in many cases the U.N. does great work, but and certainly the Haiti mission of the last 5 years, the U.N. does some things that are very detrimental to the country. In Haiti, the current U.N. mission, which is called MINUSTA, was really established to consolidate the coup d'etat of February 2004, and that was something that did not help the economic or development or political development of the country of Haiti. So I guess a big issue is, what is this $2.2 billion being used for? Is it going to be used for legitimate peacekeeping operations, or is it going to be used for attempts to rein in the democracy of a country?
What are some of the practices that the MINUSTA has been carrying out in Haiti in the last 6 years that you find especially problematic?
Well, as a lawyer, we see, as a human rights lawyer, we see a lot of the traces of MINUSTA keep coming across our radar screen all the time. They're repeatedly making warrantless arrests, and in fact, they don't deny they're making warrantless arrests, nor do they even claim any legal authority. They're bigger, and they've got the guns, and they do it. So they routinely, if they want to arrest somebody, they don't worry about a warrant, and that's never they never have. Before that, especially between 2004 and 2006, the UN was also doing murderous operations in poor neighborhoods of Haiti. They would go in. The most dramatic example of that was in July of 2005, when they went into Cité Soleil and shot, by their own calculation, 22,000 rounds of ammunition into a very densely populated neighborhood. They had actually brought ambulances with them. They pulled out the ambulances empty and left all the people that had been hit by their bullets to basically to die in the streets. And just in the broader issue of what the UN was doing, every UN peacekeeping operation in 50 years has always been to implement a peace treaty. There's been some kind of a peace treaty. But in Haiti, the MINUSTA departed from that. It was deployed when there was no peace treaty. It was deployed because there was a coup d'etat, and that it was there to support the government of a man named Gerard Latortu, who had been literally flown in from Boca Raton, Florida, by the U.S. government to run Haiti.
Are there political divisions among the nations that make up the U.N. force in Haiti? We think of countries like Brazil, which are associated somewhat with the new Latin American left, and obviously countries like the U.S. are also involved, countries like Jordan, which have no democratic traditions. Is there a real sense of there being conflicting ideological agendas on the part of the occupiers? Is there an ideological agenda which involves supporting the current government?
I think that what happened initially, I think that the MINUSTA was conceived in what I call original sin. It was conceived because the Bush administration, which had sent its own troops to occupy Haiti, they needed their troops elsewhere in early 2004. And so they convinced the UN to come in to take over so that more troops could go to Iraq and Afghanistan. And some of the Central American countries, some of the South American countries came in, especially Brazil, Bolivia, Argentina, Uruguay, and they came in under the leadership of Brazil. And the deal that was cut was that Brazil was allowed to run the peacekeeping operation, which is the first time that a country not from Europe or North America was given that kind of a leadership role. So it was actually a big deal for Brazil. And there was an implicit promise that if Brazil did well on this peacekeeping mission, that would advance its quest to get a Security Council seat, or a permanent seat on the Security Council. And that would obviously be a good thing. I think we do need more representation on of other countries besides the current veto-wielding members on the Security Council. But the price that Brazil was willing to pay was to go along with what the U.S. wanted it to do in Haiti. And the other countries followed suit, and it's been distressing that there's been so little debate either in those countries or among those countries in terms of their Haiti policy. If you talk to top-level people in those embassies, they will tell you that, yes, they're disgusted and ashamed at what their country is doing in Haiti, but they say there's always a but. We need to, if it's Brazil, we need to go along because this is our chance to establish global leadership. If it's another country, it's we don't want to pick a fight with Brazil over Haiti. They all have their individual reasons for not questioning the UN's role in Haiti.
One of the problems that we've sort of associated on the show over the past years really is certainly we've highlighted issues of violence and punitive UN raids. We've also highlighted issues where particular UN members may have stepped out of bounds without a mandate. We're talking about gratuitous violence on the streets. We're talking about obviously very serious allegations of sexual abuse that were levied against the Sri Lankan peacekeepers a couple years ago that have been, and similar cases have come up more recently. And one of the more disturbing things is there doesn't seem to be a culture of accountability, that when individual members overstep the bounds, they are ushered out of the country and aren't really put on trial. And the UN, even if it didn't mandate this activity, doesn't seem to be eager to prevent it in the future or to really address it. Is that an observation you share?
Yes, and I think it goes for both institutional acts of illegal acts in an individual. My guess is that the Sri Lankan peacekeepers who were caught in the sex abuse scandal, they were probably punished at some extent in Sri Lanka. But the reality is that has never been made public, and the world missed an opportunity to demonstrate to Haiti and to the world that there is accountability for sexual abuse. But it also goes to an institutional level. And I'll give you an example of in July of this year, one of our political prisoner clients, Father Gerard Jean Just, who was Haiti's most prominent human rights advocate, he died, and they had this funeral in Haiti. And the UN troops fired at a crowd. They tried to arrest somebody outside his funeral for no good reason. And when the crowd got angry, they fired into the crowd and they killed somebody. And the UN did kind of basically a four-year-old job of a cover-up. First, they denied it, and then they said no, the person wasn't shot by a bullet. He was hit by a rock. And when there was a video showing that he was clearly hit by a bullet, they said, oh, but it was someone else's bullet. And there's no evidence that. I've seen no credible report that anybody else had a gun, and it was fairly clear from video footage that this was UN soldiers that did shoot this person. And they've never done an investigation. They basically just say, oh, it couldn't have possibly have been us. And they're getting away with it in the sense that no one's getting punished, but they're not getting away with it in the sense that no Haitians believe that explanation, nor do they believe now anything else that the UN is doing, is saying.
At this point, Brian, can the UN mission in Haiti be reformed? Can it be changed? Can there be checks and balances put in place to actually make it effective and do some good in some way for the Haitian people, even in terms of hurricane relief or any sort of technical work, or should it just be scrapped? Should the minister troops go home?
I think it should be scrapped. I think that you need a different mission that is set up for the purposes of development and hurricane relief. And if you want to do hurricane relief, don't send tanks. Send people who are experts in hurricane relief. And my suggestion would be the huge amount of money. Last I checked, it was about $600 million a year. That instead of that going into people riding around in tanks and shooting protesters, that it be put into economic development. And that's, you could do a huge amount of good with that kind of money in Haiti if it was put into things like irrigation projects and building roads and building schools.
And I'd like to ask you in finishing, Brian, this is probably under the Obama administration the most I don't know, the administration certainly the first administration in years that's willing to really engage the hemisphere. That's the impression we get from up here in Canada. With the best will in the world, is there a role? Is there a role for a country like the U.S. with its history of intervention in Haiti? Or should the development, should the support, whatever assistance may be offered, is it more appropriate to have countries from the region with a similar history like Venezuela, Cuba, maybe the Dominican Republic to provide that aid simply because their history is less fraught and because they may know the local environment better? Is there something positive that the U.S. could do in Haiti? And if so, what would you like to see that be?
I think that there is something positive the U.S. can do. And I think it's important to criticize the U.S. policies that have undermined Haitian democracy, but there actually have been several U.S. policies and periods where the U.S. has done things that have advanced Haitian democracy and prosperity. And so it's actually not rocket science. I think a lot of the things that were done between 1994, when the U.S. helped restore an elected president, and 2000, in that period, I was in Haiti, and there were remarkable advances because the U.S. and the international community were willing. At the time, it was grudging support, but it was support for a democratically elected government. We later reversed course and decided we didn't like the type of people that Haitians were likely to elect, and started an international development assistance embargo on Haiti, and that worked too. That brought the Haitian government to its knees, and we've got a very stark contrast. And I think if we've got our choice between doing things that undermine democracy and doing things that have worked in the past to build democracy, and I think if we get back onto that, then in fact the U.S. does have something to contribute.
What kind of projects specifically? If you can just give a couple examples. Are you talking about irrigation? Are you talking about, I don't know, hurricane relief? What kind of things would you like to see the U.S. potentially be involved in Haiti?
Yeah, obviously things that are purely technical, and those are easier from a political standpoint. You just ask the government, where do you want to do irrigation projects, and they tell you, and you go do that. But even some other things in my own area, in judicial reform, there were lots of good programs for training judges, for training police officers, for training prosecutors that people I talked to 10 years later are still saying, yes, that was very helpful in my career. It helped me to do my job better. The risk of those projects is that most of them have been part positive, but they've also been used for intelligence service recruiting, which I think there needs to be a bright line rule, but that's not going to happen with any kind of judicial projects.
Do you see any positive signs in the first 9 months coming out of the Obama administration? Do you see that some willingness to engage Haiti differently?
I think there's been some positive signs. I mean, the most positive was that the U.S. played a very strong leadership role in debt forgiveness, debt cancellation. And as a result of that, I think Canada played a role as well. There was $1.2 billion of Haiti's multilateral debt was canceled in July. And that's going to translate into about $1 million a week for the Haitian government to spend on national priorities. So that's obviously positive. I think that there's some other things, the fact that the U.S. hasn't done as much negative as it had been doing, that in itself is another positive. But I also think that at the top levels of the Obama administration, they are listening to people better than any administration since I've been there. And they haven't quite translated that into action, but they do appear to be listening to the right people, the people who understand Haiti and who are willing to critique failed policies of the past instead of just saying, let's keep going on and doing the same thing over and over again.
Oui, trop somme, j'aime j'en laisser à densité. Maman qu'a pleuré, pas mon personne peut pas stopper. Propagande pour gun, moi-même, m'en pas ensemble. Réalité, toujours mon qu'a venu parler. Trop de sang, les jeunes ont déjà laissé. Trop de sang. Les jeunes ont déjà versé. Trop de sang. Les jeunes ont déjà laissé. Trop de sang. Les jeunes ont déjà versé.
Gardez en Somalie, gardez en Bosnie, et même à Paris, sans qu'à couler.
Non, non, non.
Trop préjugés, trop tradition. Arrêtez, 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 tuer. Gardez en Somalie, gardez en Bosnie, et même à Paris, sans qu'à couler. Trop préjugés, trop tradition. Arrêtez, 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 tuer.
Trop de sang, les jeunes ont déjà laissé.
Moi, tous les jours, j'apprécie la CIA.
Trop de sang, les jeunes ont déjà versé.
Mais maintenant, pour taper, c'est ça, t'as en âge.
Trop de sang, les jeunes ont déjà laissé. Trop de sang, les jeunes ont déjà versé.
Mais sing again, hey. Tu vis par l'épée et tu péris par l'épée. C'est un cercle vicieux et ça ne peut pas s'arrêter. C'est donc grand temps de faire face à la réalité. C'est pas avec les armes que les problèmes sont réglés. J'en ai assez.
And welcome back, everyone. This is CKUT, Radio Résistance, news and views from Haiti, broadcasting as part of Off the Hour. Chris Scott here in studio, along with Steve Duval-Saint. How are you doing, Steve?
Hey, I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
So far, so good, but the fight doesn't stop.
No, it doesn't.
We've been talking about the MINUSTAH in Haiti, the 9,000 peacekeepers, the $3 billion, the 6 years of occupation. And is this all for any good, or is this the priority that really the Haitian people would have asked for if they had been listened to? We're talking about the MINUSTAH in Haiti, this show, the so-called peacekeeping mission mandated by the UN that's just been extended for another year. We also want to talk, I think, about NGOs in Haiti. NGOs, you know, Steve, we've talked about it before. They're really thick on the ground. Do you know how many NGOs they have in Haiti right now?
Yeah, about, I heard, 10,000.
Yeah, so that's like probably the country with like the most NGOs per capita in the world. Haiti is about the population of Quebec.
And don't forget that there's 10,000 NGOs supposedly to, you know, come out there and help the people, because that's what the NGO is supposed to do. But then when there's a hurricane, there's nothing being done. People are dying. So, you know, hunger, people are still hungry. There's more hunger than there was even before the coup. A lot more than even before the coup, actually. So,
well, I mean, the NGOs, they really live off like the UNICEF model. They really live off like this narrative of Haitians are starving and can't help themselves, and let's go in and provide services. And the problem this causes that I think we saw under Aristide was when the Haitian government decides to maybe take some of that responsibility upon itself and say, you know what, we're the elected government, the people have given us a mandate, we want to decide what the priorities are in this country, we want to provide some of our own health care, thank you very much, and we don't need, like, you know, these Doctors Without Borders, even though Doctors Without Borders have done some good work. We want to move at some point towards a place where we can be self-sufficient. I'm not talking about Doctors Without Borders specifically, it's actually one of the better NGOs, but a lot of these NGOs, they're kind of in a situation where they don't want to run out of work. They don't want they don't want to have to go to their host governments and say, you know what, Haiti's doing fine now, thank you very much. They brought infant mortality down. The problem's less severe. We don't give us any more government grants. Don't pay for our office space in Montreal. I mean, you know.
And plus, you know, they're out there and they're living a good life. They have money coming from the outside, from Canada. And they're like kings out there, you know. I mean, everybody is pretty much, you know, looking up to them. And that's one. And one of the things that's being done, and that this is an issue that we're going to touch in the next article.
Yeah,
is the whole thing about even prostitution, about child molestation. These people could, you know, some of them are pedophiles out here. But then when they go to Haiti, you know, they could open an NGO and say they're helping, and then take advantage of the people, knowing that the people are poor. You know, it's harder for them to, there's not even a system really to have complaints. And even when there's complaints, it's hard to even prove. And, you know, so why? Because they take that advantage, you know, through the NGOs. So.
Yeah, well, I think the basic problem, obviously, there are a lot of bad apples out there. There are a lot of pedophiles who have gone down to Haiti, and people who have abused the Haitian population in other ways. But
yeah, in many ways, but that's one of the ways.
It's one of the worst ways.
One of the worst ways, yeah.
But I mean, really, the problem is, I think, just a balance of power. I think the NGOs have too much power, and the Haitian democratic institutions don't have any power, basically. And when NGOs have been criticized, when the minister's been criticized too, they're often very reluctant to turn on their own to actually, they tend to try to protect the child abusers, the human rights abusers in their own ranks and say, oh, nothing happened, or we'll deal with it internally, we don't need this to be made public.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a case which is unfortunately just one of many, the case of a supposed charity worker named Douglas Perlitz, who's associated with Fairfield University in Connecticut, who opened an orphanage about 10 years ago in Cap Haïtien, and really a sordid story of child abuse over the last 10 years is what's now coming out in court. Certainly, he's been indicted. He hasn't been found guilty, but it seems extremely likely that he he's being accused of 10 counts of sexual abuse of minors, and there are probably many, many more. That's probably the tip of the iceberg. So thankfully, this particular story is coming out. Douglas Perlitz is now in jail, facing trial in the United States. You talked to Marguerite Laurent with the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network. Anything quickly to say about that interview?
I feel like it was a little bit even emotional, you know, as I was reading the email she was sending me about, because she has like this newsletter where she sends email all the time, and then I was getting all these emails about these sex scandals in Haiti, or should I say these sex abuses, and it's heartbreaking when you think about kids, you know, that probably get their parents killed by the minister or whatnot, you know, because of the coup. They can't go to school no more. Now for them to go to school, they have to, you know, sexually please, you know, some old, grumpy, nasty dude. You know, it's just nasty.
And well, the most vulnerable of the vulnerable.
Exactly. Really. And I think it's just disgusting. And that's what I'm saying. NGOs, I mean, people say, what good could the NGOs do? I feel like saying the best thing they could do is just leave. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And I always take the same example, is that the example of Venezuela. You know, once Chavez got back to power, he got sure that all the NGOs and all of these people go back to their country. We have enough, you know, poor people out here to take care of before we go anywhere else and try to, you know, it's just ridiculous. I mean, look at even the whole scandal thing that's happening with the elections. It's on the municipal level, on a provincial level, and remember the
here in Montreal,
and there was even the big scandal with the liberals, you know, how we call those again, there's the anyways, I forgot the name.
The sponsorship scandal.
Scandal, you know, and then they're saying that they're going to these countries
to teach them how to be transparent.
It's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. FTQ. Remember the woman from FTQ when they had the conference coming up and telling, oh well, we can't trust politicians in Haiti, but then the FTQ has been caught up in all kinds of really, really corrupted things right now. That's even proven. So
yeah, well, we're not. Canada isn't an example to anyone, really.
Exactly.
I mean, I think the fundamental issue here is really an issue of power. I mean, Haitians need to be able to build their own institutions, and hopefully there'll be some accountability and some. It'll make it at least easier to prevent, or you know, at least prosecute cases of abuse like this. We'll go into the interview with Marguerite Laurent, and we'll be talking again at the end of the show.
So this is Steve from Radio Resistance, and we now have Marguerite Laurent, also known as Erzeli Dantor, which is a Haitian activist, also I should say a historian too, lawyer and a dancer in the United States. So how you doing, Marguerite Laurent?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for inviting me into your program, Steve.
You know, it's an honor. It's a pleasure for me. We always talk about your site. I always shout out your site at the end of the show. So now we have you live and direct. It's a good thing.
Oh, okay. Good. Wonderful.
Okay. So, can you tell us a little bit about who is Mr. Douglas Perlitz? And what was it that he was doing in Haiti? If he's still in Haiti, well, if he's not in Haiti, what is it that he was doing there?
Okay, very good. We're working on a case right now with Mr. Douglas Perlitz has been accused through a federal indictment.
Okay.
He's in jail in Rhode Island at the very moment as we speak.
Okay, that's a good thing.
Awaiting trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I am the head of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, as you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do really is lay out the non-stereotypes about Haiti. We talk about the non-colonial narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, mm-hmm. the colonial narrative about Haiti, the negative image that Haiti has had mm-hmm. and continues to have, mm-hmm. that mostly is not based on fact,
mm-hmm.
is being used against us in the most grotesque way possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I will lay it out for your audience. Mr. Douglas Prelitz was in Haiti for approximately 10 years, and according to the federal indictment, he has been molesting, raping, and abusing children in an orphanage that he founded to supposedly educate them.
Mm-hmm.
According to the federal indictment, if the children would not sleep with him and do the very graphic sexual acts that are laid out in the federal indictment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would urge those, anyone who is listening, who is interested in, mm-hmm. In this case, the actual document is on our website, on our at EsleyDantal.com, mm-hmm. so you can actually read it for yourself. Okay. This is not Esli Dantal making this stuff up,
mm-hmm.
or this is a grand jury that met and looked at the evidence that was presented by the United States attorneys,
mm-hmm.
and came back with an indictment, which basically said that there was cause to bring him to court.
Mm-hmm.
He is being charged with 10 counts of sexually abusing Haitian children,
mm-hmm.
and some counts of going to Haiti for sex. So basically, that's how it is. Now, the way we came into the case, people come to the Haitian Lawyers Leadership in Esli Dantal because Haiti is a very weak government, and we are very vocal with addressing human rights, even though we're just citizens and a very small organization.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when folks don't have any place else to go, they will call and they will say, and this is how it happened that mm-hmm. this case came to our attention back in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
A young boy was brought to us by a woman's organization that was in Cap Haïtien.
Mm-hmm.
It is in Cap Haïtien that Mr. Douglas Prelitz put together his orphanage for homeless boys. So anyways, back in 2005, this organization came to us and one young man explained to us how he was taken off the street and was provided with the school, but that Mr. Prelitz was abusing the children.
Mm-hmm.
It took a very, very long time and many people and many folks behind the scene and years to finally get where we are today, where there is a federal indictment.
Okay.
I have to say that one of the pivotal folks mm-hmm. was a journalist in Haiti by the name of Cyrus Seibert in Cap Haïtien, who actually listened to the children
mm-hmm.
and wrote the very first piece in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
In 2007, the Haitian police started an investigation, and later on, the Canada, I have to give a shout out to Canada police who are in Haiti.
Yes.
They had something to do with making some of these cases come to federal indictment. As
okay.
some of you may know, mm-hmm. last year there were two Canadians that were indicted in Canada, that had been molesting children in Haiti for about 10 years. One, Armand, was called the Father Teresa of Haiti, and the
Armand,
other one
you
was
are?
Rochefort.
Yeah.
Richard Rochefort. They both have been convicted. Anyways, with regards to Mr. Prelitz,
mm-hmm.
his case is in the process right now. He got arraigned on October 8th,
mm-hmm.
and at his arraignment, his attorneys asked for him to be released on bond because he was, you know, basically painted by his attorney as a saint,
mm-hmm.
and that the children in Haiti were lying, and that this was a competition or a conflict between two sectors of boys in his school and workers, and that it is because of Haiti's corruption that he is being accused because Haitians do not want to have their children be educated. That is basically, you know, that is basically what his attorney's defense was. I was, you know, fairly offended by that defense,
yeah.
and I felt that I would not let it stand. so what we did after October 8th is that we asked our network. We have a network and a website and a listserv. We ask our network of citizens, of no matter what your race is, children are our. This crime is a crime of power.
Yeah.
Of an adult taking advantage of a child.
Very cowardly.
Yeah. So we ask all adults to look at this case and ask the judge through a letter that we put together, a sample letter, and said, you know, ask the judge not to release this man on bond.
Mm-hmm.
And really that's the issue we're dealing with right now, just that part. We wouldn't have come into the case because we're dealing with five other in Haiti, and we're very, very busy. Mm-hmm. But the reason I came into the case and decided that my organization had to step up was because, you know, there was no one from the Haitian government in that court.
Yeah.
In that court, on that first day when Mr. Perlitz was arraigned, there was at least 40 people on his side, and there was nobody on the, you know, there was just, you know. And so when when the attorney for Mr. Perlitz was basically, you know, maligning my whole entire race of people, I just felt that there was something that had to be done. And so that's what we're doing right now. We're, there was going to be a hearing on October 28th, which just passed, where the court was going to rule as to whether or not to release Mr. Perlitz on bond, and we just said no, that the man is a danger to the community, and because we happen to know all of the problems and how long it took to get him here, and I also must add that now this is not me saying it, although I can tell you that I have. You know, we have knowledge of this. Mr. Perlitz has been is accused by the federal prosecutors. Now, he was investigated by not one but three different police departments, the Haitian police, along with some international police from Minnesota, investigated the case, investigated the children, and eventually that resulted in a warrant. For the arrest of Mr. Perlitz in Haiti. Now, and then, of course, the Homeland Security, U.S. and Immigration investigated him, FBI investigated him. What I have to point out with regards to that is the reason why I'm involved in this at the moment is because in that first day in that courtroom, there were many folks. Mr. Perlitz comes from a university. It's called Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. That university, when he first, the first time he ever went to Haiti, he went on a delegation, and that delegation apparently, you know, if your folks have been reading some of our work, we say there are two common stories about Haiti. One is how, you know, some white folks go down to Haiti and all of a sudden, you know, the light is shining and they see how, you know, their life has changed and they could make a difference. And that really was the story with Mr. Perlitz. He just he told everyone that he was given a godly mission to go back to Haiti and help these poor, desperate children. And he was, at the time, a sophomore in college. But, you know, he's a white man, and, hey, you know, he can do a school in Haiti. Who knows what the curriculum was, but he started a school, and he raised money through the university. Now, what's important for your audience to understand the intricacies of the Catholic Church and what's involved here and how deep this goes.
Okay.
In the federal indictment, and this is one of the things that we're always concerned is that authorities tend to protect. And this is the only way I can say it, you know. I don't mean to be unfair, but I've worked on this field for so long, it seems to me like it's protection. You know, maybe it's not protection. Maybe they didn't have enough evidence. But they said that a religious leader from the Catholic Church blocked the investigation of Perlitz for a long time, but they didn't name him.
See, that's my other question I want to ask you. Because you first said that Mr. Perlitz, he had people on his side when he went to court. Who are those people on his side?
Well, this is the thing. From the university,
mm-hmm.
he is, I mean, literally a saint until, you know, Ezeli came along and ruined his name, mm-hmm. if you hear to some of his supporters. Yeah, basically, you know, his lawyer got up in court and said this was a Hatfield-McCoy caper, and mm-hmm. that, you know, just try to minimize what had happened, and that, you know, Haiti's corrupt. You can't take for credibility the police report from Haiti. Mm-hmm. You just can't. You know, this is basically what the man was saying.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I'm sure he convinced those supporters, these people. Now to give you an aside with regards to Mr. Perlitz, as I said, you know, he started his sojourn in Haiti on a delegation. The priest, and I will name this priest, even though federal indictment has not named him. His name is Paul Currier.
Okay.
Currier. Because okay. it, you know, obviously, you know, I put my neck on the line every day for Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And if nobody else will, then, you know, the children have nobody to do this. Anyways, yeah. this the reason why I bring him up
mm-hmm.
is, and now everybody knows his name, okay? And I have to say I'm not the only one that has brought him up. There is an organization called SNAP. I think it's Survivors for Abuse Victims of Priests. That's in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, they happen to be our allies because, you know, they're like men who've been abused by priests.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and they have a section at the Fairfield University,
mm-hmm.
and that they're the ones that you know keeps talking about Paul Currier. And okay. asking for the university to take some responsibility because Paul Currier was the chaplain minister of the university.
Okay.
And apparently Douglas Perlitz was his protégé as a student.
Okay.
And you know, I don't know what that means, protégé, as a student. Okay. But Douglas Perlitz went to Haiti and then came back and with Paul Currier, they put together something called the Haiti Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I want to make is that in the federal indictment, it outlines that the Haiti Fund, I can't remember the date, you know, I think it's like from 2002, 2007, something like that. I just double-check me.
Mm-hmm.
But the figure is correct.
Mm-hmm.
More than $2 million was transferred from the Haiti Fund to a account controlled by Douglas Perlitz in Haiti. Okay?
Yeah.
So now here this is kind of ironic for me,
mm-hmm.
because I barely keep the phones on with my work.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Perlitz can raise $2 million anytime, you know, and use the university. And this is basically where his supporters came from, because
yeah.
he even, I believe in 2002 or something like that, he even mm-hmm. gave the commencement speech for the university as this wonderful graduate who has used his life to help those who can't help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where his supporters come from. And I have to say that, you know, ignorance is bliss. I sometimes I'm even forced to feel guilty that I am lifting up their eyes to ugliness because most people don't really want to know.
Yeah.
So on October 8th, when we noticed this, we, you know, we did the hard and the difficult, you know. We asked our folks to write to the judge to explain that this is not nothing new, that since colonial times and missionary times, the Christians and the perverted priests that, you know, were caught in the United States or wherever, you know, they would end up in Haiti or in Africa and continue to do what they were doing before. And so we said, this is not new. This is not something that's an exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the most grotesque abuse of poverty,
yeah.
where you are basically, you know, children and their families were told and that, you know, if you want your children to be educated, then you have to allow me to sodomize them.
Yeah.
But I have to ask you a question, because I read in one of your articles, well, one of the emails you sent to me, that a lot of those NGOs that they work in and the hotels are not named, or they're hidden. What is the reason that they give for that? If you know the answer, you know.
I don't have an answer, Steve. Okay. You know, I think it's irresponsible of authorities.
Yeah.
And this is why I do the work that I'm doing, and this mm-hmm. is why I'm standing out here. I mean, this is ugly.
Yeah,
I didn't become a lawyer so I'd have to deal in all this ugliness, but mm-hmm. it's just really, really ugly. I think the authorities are almost criminal for me
mm-hmm.
when you don't name the NGO that is molesting a child. And I gave a couple examples. And the reason why I'm going into this now is because I have to say to people that we had a tiny victory on October 28th. So on October 8th, he came out mm-hmm. to do his arraignment, and it looked as if the judge was going to be giving him a bond. And that was just totally reprehensible for me mm-hmm. because in general it's never been done before, at least not in the federal court system mm-hmm. here, where mm-hmm. there's an accused pedophile with these sorts of very grave accusations, and then you just give him bond into the community. I mean, how do you guarantee he's not going to continue this exactly. while he's on bond?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we began the letter writing campaign, and we're still going through it, because on October 28, when they had the bond hearing,
mm-hmm.
I had a busload of Haitians. I have to say, shout out for the Haitians of New York who support our work at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership. And mm-hmm. I have to also say, where was Connecticut? God knows, nobody, I didn't see anyone from Connecticut, but I did see my people from New York, and I shout out for them. They came in, and mm-hmm. I promise you, mm-hmm. when Mr. Perlitz, when he came into that courtroom,
mm-hmm.
and they took off the shackles or whatever from his hands, right, mm-hmm. and he sat down, he was joking with his lawyer, and then he turned around and looked, and there was two rows of black Haitians there. You could see les dépendants. I don't even know how to say that in English.
But a problem. Yeah. He was really, I guess, surprised. Or
he was a little surprised. He tried to hide it, but he was a little surprised. Yeah. Because you know what? They don't expect us to be anywhere. Mm-hmm. We're just invisible. People can just say anything they want about Haitians, mm-hmm. and we're just invisible, and it's okay. And so folks can go down to Haiti, mm-hmm. do their dirty work, and then...
But, I have to ask you, why is it that... I feel it's crazy, but why is it that it seems like the Haitian government that's in power right now doesn't really do nothing about it? Or, I'm even going to go further. Why is it that it seems like these kind of things could just happen in Haiti and... the government or the police? Well, the police kind of did something, but I think they got pushed pretty much. I mean, why is it that these guys could do these things for so long? And because to me, it seems like for them to get caught or for them to be for their name to be put out there, it seems like they have to do a whole lot. Like people have to complain for a whole bunch of time. I think even the Duarte, John Duarte, there's been complaints since June 2006. So why is it that I can't imagine a pedophile coming in Canada, committing pedophile things and then being accused, or being extradited 2 years after, So why is it that it takes, from your perspective, why do you think that it takes that much time in Haiti?
Well, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to you. It doesn't make any sense to me either.
Yeah.
I can only give you when I ask that question, what people say to me,
mm-hmm.
because I do ask that question because I'm always shocked. Mm. Example with Mr. Douglas.
Okay.
There's a warrant out for his arrest.
Mm-hmm.
There's U.S. immigration's investigating him. Mm-hmm. He's been to the U.S. embassy for questioning, okay? Mm-hmm. And yet he travels to the Dominican Republic and asks some of the Haitians in his his teachers and workers mm-hmm. to bring him the kids in the Dominican Republic so he can do what he wants to do.
Oh, this is crazy.
Okay? So then, who are these people who are bringing him the children?
Yes.
Those are Haitians.
Yeah.
You understand? And how do you rationalize that to yourself?
Yeah.
So I the answer I've gotten when I've asked that question mm-hmm. is that it's just so ugly that the family gets money.
Yeah.
From these men, from these pedophiles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that they can send maybe another child to school.
Yeah.
Or so that they can eat.
Yeah.
And so they sacrifice that one or two to that man.
Yeah.
And that's all I can
sad.
Say.
Yeah, it's
that's
very
that's
sad.
What I have been told.
Yeah.
You know. but it is the most grotesque, reprehensible thing to use. I don't have words, Steve, okay?
That's
And that's a lot to say for me.
No,
I don't have the words. But that's what I've been at. You know, when people ask me how does these things happen, that I'll give you an example. One of
they're
the lawyers
by the government.
I was working with very recently. You know, every Haitian, it seems to me now, are just keep telling me these grotesque stories. You know, I don't want to really know anymore.
Yeah.
But just very recently, I was. A Haitian called me up out of the blue, and it's like people are confessing to me. I mean, I don't have any expertise in this mm-hmm. in this endeavor.
Okay.
But one person said to me that with the two Canadians that were just last year convicted in Canada,
yeah.
that there was now I don't know if it's the same Canadian,
okay,
but
okay.
he said to me, you know, my father has a house in Okai because this is where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, now, you know, this is just what someone has said to me. It's an anecdote. He said, you know, he was renting to some Canadians. And no, he didn't say Canadians. He said blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And that means white folks.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard some children crying in there. And he waited until after, you know, the week, whatever the week or the month was mm-hmm. over in terms of what they had paid. And then he went to them and said, listen, I don't deal with this, you know,
mm-hmm.
take your stuff someplace else.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear children crying in your room. I don't want to hear what's going on here. Just get out of my house. And I asked him, I said, did your father go to the police and report these people? He said, no, he didn't want to get involved the police protect these men.
Yes.
Because somebody pays the police to turn around and not look.
Yeah. This is, oh my God, this isn't it. But
just, you know, just to give you an example,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, no,
I mean, it's very, very grotesque. And it's not, and we have to stand up, Steve, in
no,
this
exactly.
generation and
exactly.
say no.
Exactly. That's why we have
and,
to talk about
as
this.
As an
thing.
Example, you know, I mean, you know, I went into that courthouse,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I brought a whole bunch of other Haitians with me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we just sat there. And
mm-hmm.
I believe, okay, what happened on October 28 would not have happened. The man probably would have been free on bond
yeah.
if we didn't do what we did.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened was... he had offered the court, because it's very extraordinary for the court to be looking to give like bond to anybody who's hurting children
mm-hmm.
or accused of hurting children. So he had offered $2 million, okay, and the court had said, you know, you double that, you know, I think it's $5 million. If he came up with $5 million, they would let him be free on bond. Basically, everyone I spoke to said, you know what, he's going to get free, right? And then so
mm-hmm.
we began our campaign on October 8th to October 28th. And we asked people to write to the judge. We asked people to call the judge. And we asked people to be in court.
Mm-hmm.
We got some coverage from their local paper. And I think that and the information that we sent out, because we sent out, for instance, the information about the UN troops and how Save the Children had a report out showing how the UN troops were molesting little children. They were exchanging sex in exchange to give them food. Kids as young as 6 years old were being molested, and so forth. And that like 114 Sri Lankan soldiers were sent back in 2008 to their homes because, I mean, 114, okay?
Yeah.
Soldiers. What were they doing in Haiti? Now, this is the other thing. We've been asking, Haitian Lawyers Leadership has been asking, because there was an investigation. They had to investigate in order to deport them for sexual abuse.
Yeah.
But they have never made the report public.
Mm.
You see, and the Haitian government doesn't ask for it. And here we are, you know, the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, you know, we're asking for the UN to provide that report because we want to see it. We want to make it public. We think the Haitian public has a right to understand that they were running a brothel in Martissant where they would take the children from the streets, put them in their tanks, and parents think maybe the children did something wrong, that the children was at the national penitentiary. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, you know, parents will call us and say, you know, I don't know where my kid is. They were taken away by minister.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows? You know, they could have ended up in this brothel because that's what was going on. And I can tell you that you know, they had these soldiers from Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
As an aside, five Haitian women. You know, there has to be some Haitian complicity in this. You understand?
Yeah, of course.
Because there were five Haitian women. I give you an example of one case who considered themselves to be the girlfriends of some of the soldiers. So when the Sri Lankan soldiers were deported back to Haiti, I mean, back to Sri Lanka,
yeah.
They went with them.